In a last study, this comes from lesson 5, when I grow old and infirm. Maybe you feel like you're there, maybe you feel like you'll never get there, but we were talking about the latter stages in life. If you need a copy of the book, we still have some in the back pew. Feel free to avail yourself of that. We left off with page 19, I believe, just before the section that says what the Bible says about some great people. I do want to cover the paragraph before that because I think it's really, really important. He says, what a great blessing it is to sit at the feet of a scholar filled with the knowledge of God's Word. What would the church be today if all these scholars were gone? Are we preparing? And this is kind of thought number one. Then the second thought is, are we preparing our younger people toward genuine Bible scholarship as they grow older? Who will rise to meet the challenge of the atheist, the skeptic, the evolutionist, the modernist, the millennial that we talked about last Sunday morning, and some others? But a couple things that are, in my mind, worthy of going on here. If you have a chance to sit down and listen to somebody who's trying to present information in the form of a sermon who's really studied, and that's presented reasonably well, you can hopefully pick up some things, and that's a blessing. If you are in a Bible class that is presented reasonably well, and the fella has tried to do his homework and present some information, that's also a productive thing. You know, you're thinking, okay, I was spiritually fit. Not every preacher, not every Bible class teacher is going to be equal. Over the years, if you've heard several, you're probably thinking, boy, I really like these preachers. These are okay, and these, I mean, they were just drier than dust and dirt. And I just couldn't wait for that assembly to end. Well, that's probably not the best attitude, but we can, I guess, all feel like that. And the same thing is true with Bible class teachers. There are, over the years, as you hear people present Bible class lessons, some people that you really like, some people that you feel like you can identify with, some others, you think, boy, you know, that was just another class, and I'm just glad that's over. And then some others where it's kind of an average class. I know over my life, and I think in my lifetime, and Teresa would probably agree, that we've been more influenced by certain preachers and more influenced by certain Bible class teachers and even certain writers than others. So hopefully we're in a position to go ahead and pick up some teaching that is profitable to us. He asked this question, if we didn't have people that had really tried to commit themselves to knowing the Bible, studying the Bible, and teaching the Bible, what would we have as far as our world? We'd have a lack, wouldn't we? We'd have a void. I mean, you can study on your own, obviously, and there are now, more than ever, some really great study tools. But when you have fellows, whether it's an academic setting, that is a college, university, or in a local congregation, some people who have tried to really commit themselves to the Bible, that should be the preacher, that should be the elders, that should be the Bible class teachers, and hopefully the others. It's not going to be a good thing if you lack that in a local congregation. I will tell you, I am growing increasingly concerned about people who are really committed to Bible study. Not so much in the older generations. You've got some people that are around 45, 50 and up that I think have still done a good job. You've got some younger people out there who are still trying to learn what's right. But I will tell you this. You know, generally, if you're going to get some information that you don't already possess, where are you going to go to get it? All right, that's going to be one great source. If it's not an individual, though, where are you going to go? Internet. Are you going to go to some resource? In this case, a lot of people would pull up the Internet. Internet can be a great search tool. Where else might you go? Before the Internet came along, the doctor, if he was in there with you and he said, just wait a few minutes, I'll be right back. What was he doing? Taking a lunch break? All right, he's going to go back there. Doesn't tell you that. I mean, doesn't want to leave you with the impression, hey, there's something I don't know. But he's going to step back into his office. He's going to find the area where his books are, and he's going to research your symptoms and say, okay, I'm convinced that we need to pursue this test, or this is probably the disease that we're looking at. So we realize that there's that need to go outside of us. The Internet has a lot of good stuff and plenty of bad stuff when it comes to religious material. But there are a lot of things that are not on the net. There are a lot of things as far as religious resources that are not on Bible study programs. I mean, they are in book form and that's it. So if you go back maybe over the last 50 years, 100 years, a lot of the things have been digitized, but still there is a ton of material which is disappearing little by little. And if that material is not put into digital form, if it is not offered on a Bible study program, those things like that, you know, little by little, those books that were published that have that information is going to disappear. I've said before, about 25 years ago when I was in Fort Wayne, They had Concordia Seminary there, and it is a division of the Lutheran Church, which is kind of a scholarly division. They still produce some good reference works. And you walked in there, and I mean, it was just book, 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 book. I mean, it was a huge room, probably bigger than this room. I mean, it was just lined with books. Now, if you go there, they've turned the room into something else, and there's just really not any resource material that you can buy in the form of books. Fried Hardeman, which I just came back from, used to have book after book after book, and now it's 95% reduced, maybe closer to 100. They just lost 97-98% of the books. And when you start taking that information away, or you start de-emphasizing it, as we are seeing, I think, in the church or in the religious world, it has consequences. And I think, by and large, we're training in the church and in the religious world a lot of preachers that are getting a lot less when it comes to Bible. And that's catching up with us, little by little. And in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, if you're around in the church, you're going to hear some preaching which is a lot different than what you're getting now. I can't predict that for sure, but that to me does seem to be the trend. So he asks the question, are we preparing our younger people toward genuine Bible scholarship as they grow older? The answer in many cases is no, or we're doing a poor job of it. And if we do that, if we're doing a poor job, then what happens when it comes to answering the skeptic? What happens when it comes to answering the atheist, the millennials, some other people? You know, Peter said, did he not? Be ready to defend, be ready to answer the hope that's within you. He did. So this is a serious matter. So if you have some good books, hold on to them. Make sure you use them. And again, plenty of good resources on the web. But still, we're reaching a time where this is a very, very serious matter. Anything that you want to add or ask on that point? Okay. Let's move into the next section then. He talks about some great people. And going back to the last discussion that we had, we talked about older people, younger people, how sometimes there are some tensions between the two. They don't always get along. They don't always see eye to eye. But that's not the way it should be. Older people as well as younger people can both bring some wonderful things to the table, and sometimes they just need to figure out how to join those things together. When we think about great older people in the Old Testament, Abraham and Sarah, of course, are two people that come to mind. As we learn from the text, they were told that they would be blessed with a son when Abraham was 100 and Sarah was 99 years old. I think that's a good point. We talked about this a little bit too in last Sunday's class with the millennials. Today's society geared towards waiting or not waiting. Remember we talked about, especially a millennial, they send you a text, and how long do they want to wait before they get an answer? I mean, you better be Johnny on the spot, because they just don't want to wait 5 minutes or 20 minutes or get something back the next day. They want to hear from you right now. When you look at Sarah and Abraham, though, does the message you're sometimes going to have to wait emerge? Yes. I mean, they waited for a long, long time to have a baby. And God said, the time is just not right. You will have to wait. And that is precisely what happened. And then, after they get past the point of the childbearing years, Genesis 17, Genesis chapter 18, the text says, you know, we're going to be around again in about a year. You're going to have a baby. What was the response of this couple? Did they have great joy, or did they do something else? The Bible says they laughed. They simply thought, we're past that time, and this is simply impossible. Genesis 17, 17, and also Genesis 18, verse 13. But from Genesis 18, verse 14, the text says, at the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life. Sarah shall have a son. The son, the child was born, as God had said. And through him, of course, we find association with the promise of Jesus. Lord was part of that lineage. Sarah and Abraham, they lived many years after the birth of Isaac. And the Bible tells us from Genesis 23, verse 1, and 25:7 provides information about those years. Sarah, how many years? 107? Okay, I was going to say, I had 127, so I want to make sure we had the right number. Okay. Okay, and then we have with Abraham, how many years? 175. All right, let's pick up a couple references here. We'll get three helpers lined up. The first is going to come from Genesis 25, verse 8. Genesis 25, 8, Brian. After that, we'll go back to the book of 1 Chronicles and look at 1 Chronicles 29, verse 28. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 28. Betty? And then Jeff, if you'll pick up reference 3, this will be under the heading of Job, James 5, verse 11. James 5, verse 11.
During this time, what was the average age of a man? I can't remember where I read that. Like now we're saying it's 3 score and 10.
Yeah.
What was
But when you start looking at the flood, you go back to when people, you know, were living around 700, 800, 900 years, and you begin to follow that down after the flood, you begin to see a gradual decrease in age. Abraham, from what I could tell, would have lived for about an average number of years for his lifetime. When we drop down from about 175, you know, 150 plus, down to maybe the 80, you know, 90 range. I mean, you do get in the Old Testament, for example, back in the time of Solomon, you read about, you know, 70 and 80 as far as being a common age. So somewhere in between the time, I'm going to put Saul, David, Solomon, you know, about 1,000 years before Christ, probably within about a 1,500 year period, it seems like that continued to decrease.
So there wasn't really a time, like you said later, he tells us it's 3, 4, and 10, but there wasn't really a, he didn't really tell us anything in the Old Testament dealing with that. Because at this time, when they're thinking about having a baby, they were 50 years old. He would have been, according to our lifespans, about half that.
Yeah.
Or close to a 40-something. That's not unusual for someone to have a kid in their 40s.
Right. Yeah. When you begin to try to equalize that and look at it.
But they didn't know how long they were going to live back then.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't either, but we know we're not, I'm pretty sure we're not going to make it 175.
Yeah. Well, and true, you know, it's also true that if you deal with infertility, you know, let's say that you get married at 18, you decide that you're going to try to start having a child at the age of 20, 2 years into the marriage, and you've been trying for 15 years. You know, after 15 years, you're now 35 years old. I mean, the clock hasn't exactly stopped, but I mean, still, things are not getting better as far as the reproductive system in the body. And after 15 years, especially with those younger years, I mean, people are thinking, well, hey, if it's not happened now, you know, the chance of that, we've pretty much just written off any hope. And, you know, it was a big thing. And remember, barrenness, you know, among that particular culture, that was a big deal. So it was, yeah, bad news for both.
But yet, Abraham and Sarah did not think of themselves as a 40, 50-year-old pastor. I mean, they were past childbearing age in any way.
I think we've got, Brian, I'll take your hand, and I'm turning over to Romans 4 as you're making your comment.
Okay, well, I was just going to point out that for the sake of Abraham, he, after Sarah died, he would have been 137 himself. He took a second wife, Keturah, and had 6 more sons. So he was for a lot longer. So maybe the miracle was more on Sarah's part than him.
That's possible. I mean, you do have in the Old Testament, for example, when you think about Hannah, you know, the Bible refers to some women, God had closed up their womb. Now, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that there was a miraculous element involved, perhaps? Do we have there a situation where, you know, you've probably known of some couples that were trying to have kids for the longest time, wife got uptight about it, and then they decide, well, let's just adopt. Okay. They adopt a child, and then after the child comes into the home, what happens? Bang! Now we've got a baby on the way. Well, what happened? If you do some reading in this area as far as fertility, you'll find sometimes that, for the lack of a better expression, uptightness. You know, people just, which again kind of takes you back to the Hebrew culture. You know, the body does some weird things. And sometimes, you know, we've got to have a baby, the clock is ticking, those kinds of things, and all hope is lost. And then all of a sudden, when you have another option open up, it's like things begin to unfreeze. And you then end up with maybe more children than you were thinking about having. Let's see. You have there in Romans 4. Looking at about verses 18 and 19 and following. 18 says, who in hope believed against hope? Now think about that. He had hope. He believed against hope. Everything looked like it was stacked against him. But he still had faith. To the end that he might become a father of many nations according to that which has been spoken, so shall thy seed be. And without being weakened in faith, he considered his own body now as good as dead. He being about 100 years old. Well, not literally dead, but again, dead as far as being able to sire a child and the deadness of Sarah's womb. But he looked unto the promises of God. You have to, I think Brian was right about Keturah. You also have to think about Hagar. Because remember, Sarah says what? Can't have kids, naturally, then you go into this maidservant, Hagar, and we'll have a child by her. So, again, there did seem to be some belief that he could go ahead and have a child through her, and then with Keturah as well. Anybody else? Okay, let's get back to the lesson. Genesis 25, verse 8. Let's have that read now. Brian, if you're ready.
Then Abraham gave up the ghost and died a good old age, an old man, but full of years, and was gathered to his people.
Okay, let's fill in our blanks. Abraham, he gave up the ghost. That's a way of saying that he died. His eternal spirit passed on to the Hadean realm. He died in what kind of state? He was a good old age, an old man who was full of years. And then again, gathered to his people. That seems to be a reference to the afterlife as far as the gathering to his people, not so much something that's related to this earth. He mentions too, and I think this is a good point, he says it's doubtful that anyone ever said of a wicked person that he died in a good old age. Are there some evil people that die late in life, spend many years? Sure. I've heard some people say, well, you know, he was just too mean or she was just too cruel to die early. It was the meanness that kept them alive. Well, maybe there's some truth in that. I don't know. But generally, even if that happens, you know, it's not a good time. And certainly some people die earlier because they were not living a righteous life. Then he mentions, too, we've also got similar statements made of other Old Testament characters, Job and Dave and Gideon. Certainly that's associated with Abraham. We have a reference to David in 1 Chronicles 29, verse 28. Let's also have that read now. Okay, three things said about David. Died, full of days, full of riches, and full of honor. People spend their last days, they come to the end of their life in different ways. Some have short days, some die very poor, some have no honor at all. Bad things may be said about them and evil words may be heaped upon them. But oftentimes, you know, the person who lives for God is able to go out of this life in a very good, very peaceful, very calm, and very blessed way. He mentions correctly the Lord had richly blessed these great servants up to the hour of the death. And again, he's certainly able to do that today. No matter how infirm or helpless the body may become, God continues to bless the spirit. One of the fellows I pull from as far as material that's posted on the web wrote an article that I put out today. He said, I'm in my 81st year. So he's apparently feeling his age a little bit. And in that brief article, he said, I'm basically in a peaceful state. I believe that my heart is right. I know that I've tried to live my best for God. And now, whenever it's time for me to go, I'm ready to go. I don't know what his circumstances are as far as health and wealth or any honor. But he's reached that time where he feels like, I feel fulfilled. I feel satisfied. And if God takes me home today or tomorrow or next week, whenever that is, I'm going to be in good shape. Anything you want to discuss before we look at Job? All right, thinking about Job, we know that he was one of the older fellows, very likely back there in the time of Abraham, maybe even a little earlier. And James describes him in a very interesting way. James 5, verse 11. Jeff, is that yours? Okay.
Behold, we count them happy which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very
okay, the translation that you read is very good. Job was someone who wasn't patient in the sense that we think of it. When you look through the book of Job, you find that he was, in many ways, impatient. Out there and after his friends and after God a little bit. But he was patient in the sense of, I'm going to endure. I'm going to slug my way through this. It's difficult, it's hard, it's painful. I'm being accused of all kinds of bad things, but that's what I am going to do. And when we skip down a little bit, he also mentions Job 42, verses 12 and 13. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. For he had how many sheep? 14,000. And how many thousand camels? Six. And how many thousand yoke of oxen? One thousand. And 1,000 she-asses. He had how many sons?
Seven
sons and three daughters. I was going to preach on this not long ago. I didn't. Maybe I will someday. But when we think about God, and we've been doing that a little bit on Sunday evenings, we think about maybe God helping in the present. Maybe as we look at our life from a past perspective, we think, God helped me in the past. Or maybe with providence, we say, God, reach back into my past. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years ago. And either by the people I met, by the job I had, or by some other experiences, maybe very early in life, that has kind of allowed him to work on my life to this point where this has helped me now, something from the past. So God is helping us sometimes from a past perspective, and he's helping us from a present perspective. But you know, one of the things I don't believe that a lot of Christians give consideration to is that God is also a God who can restore. Isn't that what Job experienced? God is a God who can restore. I've gone through all this stuff. I've lost all this stuff. I've lost my family. And now God can restore to me. And you can just fill in the blank, whatever it is. Isn't that a true point about God?
Well, I think it was Peter that asked Jesus, or he made the statement, we're giving up all of this. What are we going to get for it? And Jesus said, anybody who gives up father, mother, sister, brother, wives, whatever, will gain it many times over, essentially.
Yes.
And so I think the scripture's there that points it, that that's going to happen.
Yeah. Past, present, future in the sense of eternity, but also he can restore in this life. But oftentimes I think we get short-sighted on that point. We think, oh, look what I've lost, look what I don't have. It's something I think that we need to spend a little more time on. Now, having said that, let me give this additional point. When we think about God restoring something, might it be immediate? No. Remember with Abraham, God said, you're going to have to wait. And for the Christian, that same principle might be true. God says, I'm going to restore this to you, but it may be months, it may be a year. 5 years. I mean, he can't wait forever. He's going to restore it in this life. I mean, he can't say it's going to be 75 years out. But, you know, he might make us wait for 5 or 10 years, maybe 15 years. And there have been Christians who have said, okay, I lost this, or I no longer have this person. You know, maybe it was the passing of a son, daughter, a spouse or someone, and they thought, well, hey, all hope is gone. Wait a minute. God is a God who's able to restore. So, not thought about that in a while. I think that's a good lesson to go home with. See, I don't know who I saw first, but Ray, you're closest, so I'll start with you.
Well, like the case with Moses, he prepared for 80 years.
Yeah.
His preparation. So God not only reaches in the back and takes care of things today, but he prepares us for the future.
Yeah. And there again, you, like we talked about last Sunday night, that general overview of God, God is that eternal being. He says, I am. You want to talk about past, you want to talk about present, you want to talk about future on the earth, you want to talk about eternity. God says, I've got it all covered. But far too often, I think, we just look at it in terms of time, the immediate situation, and say, well, you know, if things could have been this way in the past, or things can't be this way in the future, but God says, hey, look at me, and have faith. You have to just live by faith, and that's a tough lesson sometimes to apply, but it's an important lesson.
Going with what Ray said, see, Moses had to continue to prepare. Things didn't change if he changed his goals and what he was with his service to God. So many, and I'll say, so many Christians get downhearted and they basically say they get disgusted with God. He did wrong. And they leave the church and never give God time to restore anything. Mm-hmm. I think, like you said, it's the younger have no patience.
And that's the problem for everybody, but especially with that generation that seems to typify them, and that's one of the lessons that needs to be taught. You know, I've mentioned this guy a couple times in Fort Wayne. He lost a son, and I mean, he just turned his back on God. When I was there in Fort Wayne, I thought for sure he will never become a Christian. He will never turn to God because he had just closed his heart. And yet that fella is now there at worship. I mean, there were some Christians who continued to work with him, and, you know, later in life, he decided, okay, you know, I may not have figured everything out way back when, but this is the right thing to do. And unless something happens, I suspect that he will die as a child of God and spend eternity in heaven. So, again, for us, past, present, future can get murky, but have faith in God. Because, again, he is the I am. Anybody else? Doris?
Don't you think sometimes that's a learned process? You know, we see that happening, like you said, in our younger lives, and we see things happen and wonder, how in the world is this going to end up? And then God blesses the situation, and then, like you said, it may be years later, and you go, wow, I went through that because now he's got this for me. But you see that over and over and over through your decades, and all of a sudden you get to your 60s and 70s and go, I've learned that no matter what, it will be restored one way or another.
And I think that's where this 81-year-old guy is coming from. He was able to kind of look back over the years, but too often we get impatient. And we think that God needs to operate on our time. God, I have this need. This is how you need to do it. And you need to do it by date X. Well, you hopefully wise up a little bit more as the years pass. And thankfully, God is tolerant with that kind of stuff, where he doesn't just say, well, you didn't have faith in me, or you didn't have full faith in me, and I'm just going to cut you off. So from God's perspective, it's got to be, I would almost say, frustrating. But like I say, his patience just defy the imagination. And, you know, he hangs in there, and our job is to hang with it. That's where faith comes in. God says, you live by faith. You may not always understand. It may not seem like things are headed in the right direction, but I am over all things, and you stick with the program regardless, and I will get you through it.
Do you feel like there's a fine line between God's patience of hearing the same plea over and over and over from us, and wondering, when do I stop praying for that?
I've thought about that.
I don't. I keep praying for that. But it does make you wonder if God sometimes goes, are you still asking for that?
I've thought about that a lot. And I'll inject three illustrations here. Remember Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount talked about vain repetitions in prayer? So we know that those are possible. But I don't think that is just repetition. It is a specific kind of prayer, which I'm not going to develop right now. You also have Paul. He said, I have besought the Lord three times at the thorn in the flesh. You've also got Moses praying to God, and finally God comes along and says, hey, this is enough. You know, just shut it down. So when I put those things together, I mean, with Moses and with Paul, you do have, if you will, direct revelation there. God is saying, you know, I've heard this, and I'm not going to answer this in the way that you want, so just move on to other stuff. I didn't say it quite like that, but that's pretty much the gist of it. And then for us, well, let me toss in one more passage. Remember Luke chapter 18. Jesus talks about the widow and the judge. And this is the passage, I think, that would, in my mind, be the key thing. The widow goes to the judge. The judge doesn't want to do what the widow says. And yet, the Lord, the word that's translated there in a lot of versions of Luke chapter 18, because of the importunity, that is, because of this woman's persistence, she's going to wear him out, the judge says. I'm going to give her a request. All right, now how do you put all of those things together when we pray today? You've prayed about something 22 times, and you're thinking, okay, it's still not coming to pass. Where do we go from here? Well, remember our principle that John gives in the book of 1 John. If we pray according to his will, he hears us. So there could be some things that are outside the will of God. Now, how am I going to know if something is inside the will of God or consistent with the will of God or separate from the will of God? How are we going to know?
True.
All right, we're going to use the Bible. And we should be able to find some verses. For example, if we're going to pray that a wayward child would be restored. And, it, you know, we prayed about that for 3 months. Got a wayward daughter, and she's not come back. Is it God's will for her to come back? Absolutely. I mean, remember, leave the 99, go out and get the one. So there's no question about that. So that would be one of the things that I would look at. Okay, this is God's will. I know that because of what his word has said. You also have some other things that you can tie in there. A prayer doesn't seem to be answered. We know it's in harmony with God's will. It's not been answered. But with that principle from Luke chapter 18, how long might you need to ask? For whatever reason, God may say, this is not going to be answered on day one or day two or day three. You might need to pray about this for a lifetime. Are you willing to do that? Is it that important to you? Remember what Jesus said when it comes to Sermon on the Mount? Ask, seek, knock. Remember what he said when it came to praying? Pray without ceasing. So again, there you have the idea of consistency and fervency. The problem may be on our part. We may have some bad motives. They need to be straightened out. This may be a situation that can't be immediately dealt with. You know, the prayer has been answered, but God says some other events have to occur before this takes place, those kinds of things. So it's a multifaceted topic. But if we are praying according to the will of God, consistent with his word, and we are committed in prayer, and we have faith. And you know, faith is a strange thing when it comes to prayer. A lot of people say, you know, I have faith. I've got faith in you, God. And suppose, for the sake of illustration, you know, we're standing here on the edge of a 500-foot cliff, and God says, he wouldn't say this, obviously, and it's maybe not the best illustration, but God says, if you really have faith in your prayer that you prayed, that's what you're telling me, If that's true, just step off the cliff. How many people do you think would do that? I think they might say, well, now wait a minute. And that faith they thought they had really wasn't there. So we can, remember Jeremiah? Wasn't it Jeremiah that's, or is it Proverbs? The heart is deceitful above all things. I'd have to go back and look. I don't remember where that, even the book where that passage is right now. But the heart is a deceitful thing. And sometimes we think in our heart we've got great faith, but it's just not that way. So trying to take those passages, put them together in the best that we can. We don't have to be perfect. You've got there a recipe, I think, for successful prayer. Brian?
I think too of Jesus at the garden, that he went back and prayed something that he would think he would have known was not in God's will.
Yeah.
And in Mark 14:39 says he prayed the same words. He even used the same words when he went back and prayed again.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. 2 points about that. Yes, and maybe we're seeing more of the human side than the divine side there, where he's coming back, repeating the prayer. And I believe it's Luke's account. If you look at it, we not only have, from the account you referenced, praying the same prayer, but the Bible says in Luke's account, he prayed more earnestly, or he prayed more fervently. And that's another thing that I try to remember. If I'm praying for something that's really important, you might pray that same prayer. You might pray those same words. But if it is a matter that is consistent with the will of God, you might pray more urgently. We recognize that principle in life, don't we? Child comes up and asks mom or dad for something. First time, no. Second time, no. Third time, maybe. And if that child comes up, and I mean begs, says, this is one of the most important things to me. This really matters. And mom and dad, you believe this is right. I know you do because of what you've told me. I know you believe it's right because of what you've taught me. You think that urgent pleading might make the difference? And again, it's not that God is hesitant to give, but usually the problem, I think, is on our part. Maybe it's for bad motives. Maybe it's to increase our faith. We need to pray for a while longer. Those kinds of things. We kicked around at a preacher's meeting. I don't know that they accepted my conclusion, which is okay. But I threw out one possibility that... let's say that I'm the new Christian, and let's say that Ree's been a Christian for 50 years, okay? From the standpoint of what God would require in prayer to answer prayer, I'm inclined, and this is an opinion, but I'm inclined to think God might expect a little less of me as a newer Christian, as someone who's weaker in the faith than Ree. For example, if you put it in practical terms, you know, maybe I've only got to put, you know, 2 hours into the prayer. And Ree, maybe God requires 50 of him. Not because he favors me more than Ree. But remember what Jesus said, that principle, to whomsoever much is given, of him shall much be required. So again, you know, Ree's gotten much there as far as faith and learning about God, those kinds of things. And maybe for some prayers, God's going to say, okay, Ree, I want to help you. But at the same time, looking at your Christian life, more is going to be required of you than me. Because he's able to give more when it comes to prayer. So a lot of things there need to be borne in mind. So there's a mini lesson on prayer. Anybody else? Okay, let's think about Job a little bit more. We're now down to David. David, 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 1, calls him the sweet psalmist of Israel. And we also learn from the book of Acts chapter 13, verse 22, that he was a man after God's own heart. David had, as we look at his life, you know, there were times where he certainly prayed. We see that in the Psalms, and he's sometimes begging, crying out with that earnestness. You know, God, deliver me. My enemies have surrounded me. It looks like all hope is gone. He certainly went through many of those kinds of things. He had, you know, family problems. I mean, that what you can just go through and, you know, family problem after family problem after family problem. A lot of that stemmed from his involvement with Bathsheba. Bible talked about the sword never departing from his house and so forth. He mentions a couple things here. You know, expelled from his throne. You know, family member after his reign. Frustration, worry. And he certainly had some big blemishes on his life. You know, a lot of people think about, you know, Bathsheba, but that certainly was not the only problem that he had as we look at the scriptures. Unlike some people, though, he could say, I have sinned against the Lord. David had a good heart. If you were to look at Saul, for example, in the contrast to him, what kind of heart do you find with Saul? You find a hard heart. You find a fella who's willing to excuse sin. Oh, it's the people. You know, you didn't show up in time, so offer the sacrifice. And it's not a heart which is willing to stand up and say, I did what's wrong. But David, however, he did need to be confronted. Nathan comes along and says, thou art the man. And yet when that was done, David was willing to show great sorrow and remorse for his sin. The Lord did not forsake David when he was old. 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 1 describes him as an old man who was stricken in years. God confirmed his kingdom through who?
Solomon.
Even though who? Adonijah exalted himself and tried to usurp the kingdom, as we see from the book of 1 Kings 1, 5, and then, of course, verse 39 as well. Anything you want to discuss before we look at some great men and how they're not always wise? Okay, next section. This is coming from Job chapter 32. Let's have somebody skip over there. The statement that he pulls from is verse 9. But let's back up a little bit and look at Job 32, starting with verse 6 and reading down through verse 9. As you look at this, it's information that's coming from Elihu. Elihu was one of the fellows who tried to offer some consolation and comfort to Job. And in Job 32, Elihu is younger than Job. We don't know how much younger. But there is really a contrast. Elihu is presented as a young guy. Job is presented as the older guy. So today we could have a fella who's maybe 20. The older guy is 40. Or you could have a guy who's 40, another guy who's maybe 75. But there is apparently a pretty good, a noticeable difference in age. Job 32, let's start with verse 6 and read down through 9. Who's got it? Jeff.
And Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzzite, answered and said, I am young, and ye are very old. Wherefore I was afraid and durst not show you mine opinion.
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, age is speak, a multitude of years is no wisdom. How do I?
If you would, please.
But there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty giveth them understanding. Great men are not always wise, neither do the aged understand judgment.
Okay, thank you. You see there from that fuller reading, the statement, neither do aged understand judgment. Well, that's not always true. But there are times when it is true. Does anybody get it right all the time? No. I mean, sometimes there's a younger person that draws a conclusion or points something out that the older fellow should have seen or older woman should have seen. But the older person misses it. But oftentimes it's the older who is able to see some things that the younger don't realize. And maybe that's because they've had some experiences, maybe they've personally gone through certain things, but older people often do have some wisdom, but sometimes they make some decisions which the writer describes as unseemly. Thinking about Solomon, when this man's name is mentioned, the first thing that pops into most people's minds is that he was the wisest man on earth. You know, he was given by God a choice. What do you want? Solomon comes along and says, well, I've got this great kingdom, and if I'm going to rule over this, I just don't have the wisdom, the insight. So he wanted wisdom, and God blessed him with that. If you were a ruler, why would you want wisdom? A lot of people would say, well, just give me money, give me a lot of territory, give me, you know, great warriors. Why wisdom?
Because wisdom is what would take everything away from you.
Yeah.
Be able to gain.
If you don't have any sense, you're not going to be able to keep what you give. I mean, God could just pour all kinds of stuff on you, but you just allow it to kind of fritter away because you're not using, you know, good sense and good judgment.
I would think that with the wisdom you know how to deal with the other emperors and other kings,
yeah,
presidents of different countries that's around you, that may bring a lot of threats to you.
Look at right now. I mean, no president thinks that he's so smart, so wise, that he can just go it alone. So they have a cabinet. You know, you got your war secretary, and you've got your commerce secretary, and you've got your secretary of defense, all those kinds of things, so you can have people that can give you some advice, your advisors. Today's world, I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like being president. I mean, you probably just got a board with all the hot spots in the world. And, you know, you walk by that each time and you're thinking, oh, wow, what are we going to do with all the problems in the nation? So the writer here does specifically mention trying to keep peace with nations, be a magnet of those far and near, and impress people like the Queen of Sheba. She came along, she made a very long journey to see the wisdom, and she was really impressed by what Solomon was able to do. But even the wisest of men do not always make good choices. Even the smartest people do not always make smart decisions. He mentions in 1 Kings chapter 11, Solomon laid aside the wisdom, followed his own inclinations. Verse 1 says he loved many strange women. Well, Why were they strange? Pink hair?
They weren't his.
They didn't know God.
All right. They were from paganism, basically. They did not know God. So that's what the text is trying to tell us. Verse 2 shows that he ignored God's warning about forming ties with the heathen. God said, what will they do? They will turn away your heart after their gods. And he had amassed quite a few ladies. How many wives?
700.
How many concubines or secondary wives? 300. 1,000 women. Now, if you read through that and you looked at verse 4, when did this stuff happen? Was Solomon young when his heart's turned away from God? Does verse 4 tell us he was in his middle years or he was old? He was old. Or at least older. But yeah, I mean, it's not like he's in his 20s and he's got 1,000 women to run with. I think there's a couple lessons there. Would you want to take a stab at what one of them is? Solomon, it's in the older years that these women begin to turn him from God.
One wife's enough.
Oh, man, you're going to have a rough night.
Well, your wife's
an
artist,
so, man, all right, too much drama is an answer. What else? Now, isn't sin a lot of times gradual? May not reach you today, may not reach you tomorrow, but it's there and it just kind of builds and builds and builds and finally one day it's there. Now you got 1,000, you know, in one respect I kind of look at Solomon, I thought he must have had some stamina. I mean, if his wives didn't turn him away in the younger years, I mean, if he's able to go ahead and withstand their influence for several years until he gets into the older years, I mean, he did have a certain degree of stamina and a certain degree of fortitude where he just wasn't willing to do that. So he's still messed up, but at least that dimension, that part of it is commendable.
Did he actually go through ceremonies or anything then? Did he marry again?
A lot of them were political alliances. For example, if President Obama is married, but for example, let's say that he were single, and you've got the princess over in Iran, for example. President Obama could, potentially marry her, and chances are you're not going to nuke Iran because that's where your wife is from and you're on friendly terms with the nation. So a lot of those were just really designed as kind of what Ray was indicating earlier, to keep peace between the nations. So you bring her in, you provide an apartment for her, a hotel, and, jewelry, those kinds of things, and, take care of her. One of the interesting things, it's kind of puzzled me about Solomon, but when you read about him in the Bible, you don't find too many children. Now, if you were having, a sexual relationship with hundreds of women, you would think, just by the odds, that you'd be producing a lot of kids. Now, if he had a lot of children, that's simply a detail that's not recorded in the Scriptures. So, I have to wonder how many of the women he was sleeping with. There may not have been that many. So if you think he's got a different woman in his bed every night, that may not have been the way it was. It may have been more of a social arrangement, if you will, that we're going to be on good terms with Dad and you can come here and we can provide all kinds of nice things for you and those kinds of things. So we don't know exactly how it was, but when you look at those details, I'm going to put them more in the political alliance or, I just like you, you're somebody to talk to, and, we're just going to have a big party at times.
That's a bad word, though. Wives, because technically you're not married. Your marriage isn't consummated until you slept together. So, were they truly wives?
Yeah.
So it just depends on what the word really means. Yeah. You look it up to see what the whatever Hebrew or Chaldean, whatever it was.
Yeah. I mean,
because concubines to me are livings.
Yeah. That almost it's kind of a crude arrangement by our standards today, but they were kind of secondary wives. So. And then when you figure, the princess, she's got some maidservants, presumably. If each one had just one, now you've got 2,000 women running around. So it was a very interesting life. Just the females could have kept him very, very busy. So an unusual situation for sure. Okay, verse 6, Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord. And again, this wasn't a quick thing based on verse 4. It was something that came along with time. Verse 9 says, the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Lord. And then as we look at verse 11, what was the result? Okay. Kingdom was going to be torn. The kingdom was going to be rent from him. And that is exactly what happened. So,